Hello and welcome. This is Jay Abraham. I'm here at Capistrano Beach with Fran Tarkenton. I should set the stage. We are right on the beach, so you might hear some waves crash, some children running, or a seagull come by to visit. That only adds to the fun of the interview. Everyone knows Fran Tarkenton as a sports legend. He's played in 3 Super Bowls. He was in the Pro Bowl 11 out of 18 seasons. He set 4 separate records as an NFL quarterback that still stand. All that is remarkably impressive, but what most people don't know, and what to me is even more impressive, is his business track record. Fran has started 8 separate enterprises from scratch, giving birth to them as ideas from the ground up, from the dirt, as he so charmingly says, and built them into very powerful and very successful enterprises, all without conventional borrowing, all without venture capital, and he sold those businesses for an aggregate total that exceeds $200 million. Now, in a business climate like today, you might be experiencing more than a little bit of challenge just keeping your one enterprise or practice going. I thought this would be a real opportunity for me to be able to pick the brain, learn the strategies, and understand the very successful mindset of a man who could do this, a man who could do it not once, not twice, not 3 times, but 8 times in a row with not just decent, but phenomenal success. So without any more fanfare, Fran, welcome and thank you in advance.
Thank you, Jay. I'm glad to share this lifelong experience with your friends.
Now, I got to say this. I know, and I've looked at a lot of your press, I don't think you've ever given an interview like this. I don't think you've ever documented, and I know from previous conversation, you haven't even had the opportunity to sit and draw out what some of your specific philosophies and strategies are. So this is going to be a real exciting discovery for both of us.
Well, the reason for that is I've spent most of my last 25 years running businesses.
You've been an operator.
Starting businesses, trying to figure out how to find a customer, how to satisfy that customer, how to grow the business, how to price my products, how to price my service, how to collect that, how to create cash flow now and beyond. And that's where I've been. You know, I have listened to your stuff. I love it. I've listened to Tony Robbins. I've worked with Tony Robbins and Tom Peters and Covey and all the wonderful informational people. The difference is, while I've been listening, gleaning from all you guys, I have been doing it. I have been doing the same thing as our listener there in running and operating and growing businesses, creating profits and services that someone wanted.
I like it. Somebody said one time, he got his education on the front lines of capitalism. And I would say that's what you really did. You basically, each and every day, you fought the battles in the field of commerce right on the line. So with that stated, I'm going to ask you questions. First question I want to know is, hey, you're minding your own business, being a Hall of Fame football player, playing in Super Bowls. What got you started as a businessman in the first place? Can you go back and give
sure.
me the motivation?
Jay, I've always been an entrepreneur. When I was 5 years old, I lived in Washington, D.C. I lived at 610 Maryland Avenue. And I was the son of a preacher man, and we didn't have much money. And on Saturdays, I used to take my little wagon down to the Safeway grocery store. Because women back then, and mostly women did the shopping back then, did not go to the grocery store with their car. They would walk to the grocery store, it was a neighborhood grocery store, and then they would carry their packages of groceries back to their house. So I said, you know, I see this happening. So as a 5-year-old, probably copied my older brother, some other kids, but I saw what they were doing. They were making money. So I went down to the Safeway store, and at 5 years old, I would put their packages on my little wagon and drag the wagon to their house, and they'd give me a dime or they'd give me a quarter. Then when I was 8 years old, I delivered the Washington Star, as it was then, as a paper delivery boy in Washington, D.C., and I did that till I was 11 years old. And then I went on, and finally, when I got to college, I sold life insurance for the Franklin Life Insurance Company, and I was the leading life insurance salesman in the state of Georgia
in the year
1960, part-time. I sold the PPIP plan, the President's Passbook Investment Plan. So my entrepreneurship goes a long way back to the time that I was 5 years old. Now, I go to professional football. I was drafted in the 3rd round by the Minnesota Vikings, 1961. My starting salary was $12,500. They paid me a bonus of $3,500. I had to work in the off-season, so I had an off-season job. I worked selling freight for the Wilson Truck System, $600 a month, and they gave me a car to drive, and I went, and here's how glamorous my job was. My job was to be able to sell people who were shipping freight between Sioux Falls, South Dakota, to Minneapolis, Minnesota, to Chicago, and back. And I would go in the dead of winter in South Dakota, in Watertown, South Dakota, Aberdeen, South Dakota, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and knock on the doors of shipping clerks and convince them, or try to convince them, that they ought to use Wilson Truck System to ship.
Were you persuasive?
Yes, I was persuasive. Rates were all the same. But I understood at that time, the way I got their business was I could not lowball the number. I could not offer any better service than our competitors did, because they offered good service too. It was building a relationship, getting to know the person, making an investment of time, and sitting down with them and listening to them and asking them questions and building a trust. When I would build a trust with them, and that might take a week, but most times it took weeks or sometimes months, I would finally get a chance to get some business. So I learned perseverance. I learned tenacity. That all of that led to me getting business. Just by being an athlete, walking in, never once got me business.
Then how did you go from that employment to owning your first enterprise?
Well, okay. I went from there. I then sold printing for Holden Printing Company. I worked for an advertising agency back in Atlanta, Georgia, BBD&O. I then worked in the marketing department of the Coca-Cola Company for 3 years, and I did that. Now we get to 1969. 1969, I'm 29 years old. I'm still playing football, and I decided then that I really wanted to take the skills that I had learned, the entrepreneurial spirit, and I wanted to go out and start my own business. The first business I started, I figured out that I had to find a need for something. I had to create, if you will, an idea that people would find useful and would pay money for.
So you had to find a way to bring a new value or a new benefit
yes.
to people.
So I lived in the heart of the textile country. Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Alabama, Tennessee was the heart of the textile country. Mm-hmm. And so I got to know a lot of textile people. And being out there, and I was doing a lot of networking, a lot of speaking back then, I found out an amazing thing. That their turnover rates were just outlandish.
You're talking about employees who would leave.
Employees would leave. And they were running, on the average for the industry, about 65% turnover every year.
Wow.
So if you had 100 people, 65 would quit and 65 new ones would have to be hired. Cost of that turnover was probably at that time about $5,000 to $6,000 per employee. Cost them a lot of money. Now, the results of that was their quality was going downhill. There were more seconds.
Reject rate was high.
Productivity was non-existent.
So there's a tangible cost that they could measure that they were suffering right
That's
then.
That's exactly right.
So what'd you do?
So during that time, I had come in contact with some people that were in the behavior modification world. I became knowledgeable about Skinnerian techniques and behavior modification.
But for those people who don't know what behavior modification is, what is it?
All right. Behavior modification was more of a systematic, scientific approach to human behavior. It said, we're not going to look at you inside and try to figure out what's going on or not going on with you. We're going to look at observable, measurable behavior. And when we look at that observable, measurable behavior, we can see it and we can count it. And if we can see it and we can count it, then maybe through the methods of feedback and positive reinforcements and managing the consequences, if you will, of that behavior, we could impact that to get more of it or less of it.
So back then, were you on somewhat of the cutting edge relative to that?
I think we were on the cutting edge, and especially in the industry, because the industry wasn't using that. So anyway, I got the notion I could take this technology, if you will, and modify it for industry and go in and really make an impact. So I went to Cannon Mills. Their vice president of human resources was Murray Hudson. Cannon Mills, at huge. That time, had about 70% of all the towel business in the world.
Yeah, huge corporation.
Huge company based in Kannapolis, North Carolina. Conservative company, never had outside consultants. So I went into this guy, Murray Hudson, who was vice president of human resources. I said to him, I believe that I can reduce your turnover and cut your turnover in half and save you hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And did you really believe that?
Well, I believe that.
Because?
And he said, how can you do that? And I said, I believe the way to do that is not through a program that has a beginning and an end. It's not just in making speeches to your group or having a seminar every so often. I need to have someone here live here every day, work first shift, second shift, and third shift, because they had three shifts of work. And we are going to work with your supervisors, because I think the key to this whole notion is your supervisors. I don't think your people are quitting because they are not getting paid as much as the person across the street. I think it's because they are not getting the recognition, the proper supervision, the proper feedback, the proper direction from your supervisors. And the reason they're not because your supervisors are bad, it's because your supervisors don't know how to. So we came into this environment and convinced him that we were going to do supervisory training. But that supervisory training would have classroom training for 2 hours on a Monday morning, and then 2 hours on a Wednesday morning, and 2 hours on a Friday morning, and the rest of the time, my consultant who had been trained to do this was going to work with those supervisors in implementing what they learned in the classroom.
This was the first client you went to?
First client. So I convinced them, we trained them, we then worked with them, and we brought graphs up. We would graph and get baseline graphs on performance data, attendance data, seconds, productivity, and so forth. So he bought into that. Now, how am I going to finance this? I knew the person I was going to hire because I had already worked that out with him.
So did you have a company set up?
I had no company.
Just an idea.
I had no money. I wasn't going to go to the bank and get financing. So I worked out what it was going to cost me to hire this gentleman to work for me. I knew what that was going to be. And then I knew what his living expenses were going to be. So I figured all that out, and I said, I need to have cash flow to start my business. I need to have cash flow to grow my business and to hire the second and third and fourth person. So I came out with knowing what my costs were going to be, and then I figured out for me to have an adequate profit margin to be able to grow my business and deliver the services I needed to do, I needed to charge this guy $9,000 a month. So I convinced him. I said, I want a five-month commitment from you.
Normally it'd be a year or two, though, wouldn't it?
Would be a longer time. I said, I want 5 months, pay me $9,000 a month, guarantee me $45,000, and if we haven't impacted your business dramatically in reducing your turnover...
In a measurable way.
Measurable way, reducing your turnover, increasing your productivity. In other words, we were going to get more towels out the back end. Then if we haven't done that for you, then you can break the contract. That's fine. So I've got a contract for $45,000. Normally they would pay you 90 days after you bill them after the first month.
Sure.
I couldn't afford to do that. So I had to have money up front. So I said, one other thing. We're going to start April 1st, 1969. And I need you to pay me at the first of every month. He said, why do you need me to pay you the first of every month? I said, because that's how I'm going to fund my business.
So you're honest with me.
I'm a small business person. I don't have the financing mechanisms. I don't have the capital that you have at Cannon Mills. I can bring your service. I can bring results. But I need to pay you to pay me on the first of every month. So he gave me a check for $9,000 on the first of every month. I created a positive cash flow, and that was my first business.
It sounds like you've been results-oriented from the very get-go.
Okay. They had a need. I knew their need. If anybody could come to them and show them how they could reduce their turnover, increase their quality, and have more towels out the back end at the end of the day, increase productivity, increase performance, this made money for Cannon Mills.
So you've always been focused on that.
Always. And so I had to bring value to them. I had to make them more money. If I could show them that I could make them more money, they would be willing to spend money with me.
Which makes sense.
And if I couldn't do that, I had no reason to be in their shop, to be in their factory, or to expect them to do business with me.
Okay, you've worked, since you sold your last corporation for a lot of money, I might add, you've had the opportunity to travel around the country and speak to very large groups. Many of them are entrepreneurs. Many are presidents of large private and publicly owned companies. Many are middle and upper level managers, and many of them are people destined to be middle and upper level managers and presidents of companies and their own entrepreneurs in the future. What's the most frequent or constantly asked questions you get posed to you through all your travels around the country from business owners, and what's your response?
Whether it's a multi-billion-dollar corporation or whether it's a young lady who I met in Iowa a few months ago who was starting her own home business, and she had two customers. The question that they ask me is, how do I get another customer? How do I grow my business? How do I go from two customers to five customers? Or from a billion-dollar corporation to a $1.5 billion? See, we've gone into this cost-cutting phase over the last 4 or 5 years. IBM has fueled their profitability now by not innovation and creativity and increasing their revenue base. They have done it by eliminating 150 to 200,000 jobs, selling off businesses, and that's created a large reservoir of cash for them. That's fine at some point, but at some juncture, we have got to create more revenue. We've got to add more customers in order to not only prosper, but to survive tomorrow.
How do I do it?
It's an interesting question, and I do have, I think, a very solid answer to that. I think that we are living in the fastest period of change in the history of civilization. And I think that we are going through, in the last number of years, the most significant change in business that we've had since the 100 years of the Industrial Revolution. Because when the Industrial Revolution came, it changed our life. And what happened with the Industrial Revolution, a few large companies were formed.
Yes.
And those big, large companies dictated to the customer what they could have and what they could buy. And it was very hard to break through that cartel. It was almost impossible for somebody to be in the automobile business but Ford and General Motors and Chrysler.
Today it's not the case.
Absolutely not the case. It was almost impossible for anybody to be in the computing business but IBM. Think of this. 15 years ago, IBM had 60% of all the computing business in the world and 75% of all the profitability from the computing business in the world. General Motors, 10 years ago, had 49% of the domestic automobile business. Dominated, dictating you should have mainframe computers, you should have big automobiles, and didn't listen to the customer to let the because the customer had no choices. That's changed in the last 10 years. Because now, it's not like when Ford started. It was like you could have any color Ford you want as long as it's black. One size fits all. Today, you can go within 30 minutes of where you are right now and you can get a choice of 600 different styles of automobiles. You can find any number of PCs, software products by the thousands. And so therefore, the consumer is king again. And what the consumer is saying, I don't care whether you're IBM or you're J. Abraham, or you're Fran Tarkenton, or you're Herman Schwartz, or Betty Friedley. If you've got a product and a service that can add value to me, that can make me money, that can make my life better, and you're going to build a relationship with me and support me and fix it when it's broken, and I can trust, I will buy it from you. So what's happened is you're seeing companies that didn't exist 15 years ago, 16 years ago, Apple Computer, becomes a multi-billion-dollar company. Microsoft in 1982 was a $4 million company. They are where IBM was. They control today, through the standards of their operating systems, they really control more than anybody else the computing business of the world. So therefore, the opportunity for small businesses is great. There's one criteria. Have a product in mind, have a service in mind that makes somebody else money, that makes them better, that adds significant value to them, and build a relationship of trust and support that will build loyalty.
I approach it from a slightly different way, but we're very parallel in our philosophies. My whole take on life and business is this. You can't be successful unless you offer the customer or the client a perceivable benefit or an advantage. I call it a unique selling proposition or advantage, but it's something that distinguishes your company, your product, your service in the eyes of the customer above, beyond your competitors. And you're saying the same thing from a different point of view.
But it's got to be real, see. We really went through an era thinking that I could just have great marketing and great packaging and great advertising, and I could have this image of what I am or what my product is, and they would buy that perception. We might have it one time. We don't anymore.
So what's real?
IBM spent $100 million to promote the PC Junior. There are no PC Juniors around anymore because people didn't want the PC Junior. We have a sophisticated buyer today. We have a very informed customer base today. This customer base has choices. They're smart. But what's great about it, I can be a small-based entrepreneur just starting out, and if I can show that customer that I can provide them with a product or a service that really adds value to them, that makes them money, that is the basic fundamental criteria to starting a business. If I cannot make you money, if I cannot provide you something that you really need or perceive you need and want in real terms, I don't deserve your business, and I need to find some other product or service that can. Because all the marketing you have, IBM had $100 million to market. They couldn't make it work. But all the marketing you have, all the advertising will not overcome a product or service that is not wanted by a customer.
Let's talk about adding value, because I think that that's the core essence of what's probably distinguished your successes. It has distinguished the hundreds and hundreds of successful entrepreneurs and business owners I've had the privilege of working with and observing. But I think for our listener, I got to get specific. So let's talk about how you add value and what value really is. Give me examples from your own either life experience, observations, or your travels of how specifically different business owners, different companies, different professionals, different entrepreneurs have successfully added perceivable value, what the value is and how it's worked.
Let me give you one example. I've got a friend that I'm spending money with now. He's a tax consultant. And he wasn't particularly going anywhere, making a decent living. And he got an idea that he could help property owners save money on their property taxes. And here's what he did. He went to the public records, and the reason I know this, he wrote me a letter.
Okay.
And he went to the public records, and he saw that the city of Atlanta, the county of the Fulton County, and the public records had raised the valuation of my property from X to X plus 2. And he said, whew, that seems extreme, and these things are negotiable. I didn't know they were negotiable. So he wrote me a letter and said that you are in the top 25% of the homes in Atlanta in the rate of increase of valuation for your home, which was going to mean I was going to pay significantly more taxes than I had the prior year. He said, I believe I can help you. And what I would be willing to do is work free for you, and any savings that I save you from this appraisal value, I will take 25% of the savings. Made sense to me.
Heck of a deal.
Great deal. He could save me money. The investment on me was no money. I was going to pay the increased taxes, and he went to work in my behalf. And he has saved me significant sums of money, which I was glad to pay him 25%. I have gone and told other people about him. He's done the same thing. And so he's fueled a whole new part of his business that he didn't have before.
What's the lesson there?
The lesson is, again, look for a value that you can add to someone else. The reason I hired him was he was going to make me money.
Okay.
Not because I didn't even know the man. I got a letter. I throw letters away.
I understand.
But when he said he was going to make me money and he made sense with it, he knew about the valuation increase in my house, so he'd done some research. He was real and he delivered. Let me tell you how you can, another example. There are about 1,700 distributors of Midas mufflers, small business. They're all independently owned. If a person comes in to get their muffler replaced at a Midas muffler shop, one time, $125. But the average person who owns automobiles during the course of a lifetime will spend $6,085 getting their mufflers replaced. So what does that mean to me if I'm a Midas muffler distributor? It means when that person comes into my shop, I don't just want to fix their muffler. I want to make this the most satisfied customer in the history of the world.
So there's a high probability I'll come back.
I want to get to know who you are. I want to know your name. I'd like to put that in my database. I'd like to know your family name. I'd like to know what kind of car you drive. I'd like to be able to communicate with you by letter because I want to build a relationship with you. I don't want you to go across the street next time to get your muffler replaced. I want you to come to my shop. And now what I also can do, since I have you as a customer, I can now bring you in and start fixing your brakes for you and doing other things so I can expand my business by selling you, satisfied customer, more services that you want and that you need. And as a customer, I would rather you've delivered for me, you've supported me, you've given me good quality, I can depend on you, I trust you, so sell me other things that I might need.
So give me a formula. What's the easiest formula you can give to me to help it be easy for me to start asking the right questions, engaging and meeting the right people?
I can give it to you right now.
What is it?
Do not be obsessed with making money. Be obsessed with adding value to someone else. Be obsessed with creating worth for somebody else with product or services. And when you're obsessed with doing that, when you take your focus away from making money for me, because if I'm obsessed with making money for me, how can I be obsessed with your needs?
If you can fall in love with your customer and be absolutely dedicated to doing things that will make their life better, you can't help but be massively successful. I think you're saying the same thing from a different focal point. But it's so powerful in its simplicity. One little shift in the way you start looking at every aspect of your life, your customers, your employees, your vendors, your family, can change massively for the better the success and the fulfillment and the richness financially and emotionally that you can get out of not only business but just being alive. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that because I think it has merit here.
Okay. Well, I think it's evolved, and I think that through all my successes, I've had a lot of blips. I've had a lot of blips on the chart. I mean, you're talking to a man here who failed in 3 Super Bowl games and in front of the largest television audience in the history of the world.
Never thought about that.
We went out.
Interesting distinction.
And we went out and played in the Super Bowl game and lost. We couldn't blame the Russians. We couldn't blame the Republicans or the Democrats. It wasn't they. It was us, our skills against the skills of the Oakland Raiders, the Miami Dolphins, and the Pittsburgh Steelers. And the day we played them in front of the world, we failed. I fumbled. I threw an interception. So I've also failed as well as succeeded. But here's the difference. I find, and I'm with all types of people that have done wonderful things and some that have not done such wonderful things. And I see the people that are productive continually over a lifetime, that continue to search and to stretch. Failure, they've all had it. They all have it. We all have it. But it's not a devastating experience. It is just kind of a blip on the chart. It happened. I learned from it. I go and use that, maybe the energy from that failure, the hurt from that failure, the disappointment from that failure, I take that energy, and rather than let that energy drive me into depression, into why me, Lord? Why does this black cloud always, you know, follow me around? Why is it always, you know, you're not letting me, and why is everybody else luckier than I am, and, you know, have the better break and get the better job and, you know, make the most money? Rather than do that, I take those opportunities, and my greatest accomplishments have come after my biggest failures.
Interesting. Why do you think that is?
Because failure is not terminal. Failure is not a destination. Failure is just another of life experiences, but it hurts more. The failure hurts more than the success. And so therefore, I take, and let me tell you about the Super Bowl game. The first Super Bowl game that I was in against the Miami Dolphins, and we played them in Houston, in Rice Stadium in Houston, Texas, and this was my first Super Bowl. This is it. Well, we're going to win. We're the best team. All the glory, all the power, and bam, in 60 minutes, it's over. And we've lost. And people trashed us. People stopped writing about us. They called us losers. They wouldn't speak to you. My phone stopped ringing. So I could say, wow, those no good so-and-sos, why do they do this to me? You know, I know who my friends are now. I got, you know, 2 or 3 who now will talk to me. The rest of them have gone away. And they're calling me losers. They're writing about me in the paper and saying, he's a loser. He can't win the big game. And I can accept that, or I can do something with it. And so what I did in each one of those Super Bowl games. I went back the next day when I got home, and I started lifting weights and throwing balls in the mats, and I took this little small 6 foot frame, 185-pound body, and they said I was small but slow. That's not a good thing to say about an athlete. And I went back and used that terrible negative energy of hurt and of anger, and rather than let that take me down and focus on getting back at them, whoever they are, they weren't going to impact me. No article was going to change my life. That writer didn't even know who I was. That fan in the stand who booed me and threw things at me, they never knew me. What I really realized that I had the power to make a difference in my life. The writer didn't have the power to make a difference. The people who wanted to pull me down, to drag me down, to tell me I couldn't do it because I was small but slow, they didn't have the power to drag me down. I had the power to make a choice, either to go down and believe them and acknowledge them, or to take control of my life and use this whole negative energy into a positive energy, a positive force, and refocus that to create some value and some worth going forward. And so that kind of fueled me. I've grown from there. And through the last disappointment I've had of, I really thought my software company was going to be the next Microsoft. And I sold the company for over $100 million. That paper now is worth over $150 million. Significant moneymaker, significant contribution. The things we did were very significant. We helped information technology people use our software tools to build more complex systems than they could ever build before. We made it better for them. And I wanted to build another Microsoft, but we didn't. And so we sold the company. But it was a terrible disappointment. People trashed me. I got trashed by the Wall Street Journal, by Business Week. And so it really put me into a self-reflective situation. And it hurt. I had unbelievable anger. And my first instinct, I'm going to get them back. And the anger was real. I mean, I felt it. And what just kind of came over me was the realization, again, I could submit to that. I had a choice to submit to that, and I was going to focus that anger in a negative way, and that would drag me down, and I could never, never get anything accomplished.
Enormous amount of energy to funnel negatively.
And what I did, I transferred that energy into something much better, because I deliberately focused then on my life. And I said, you know, why are you here, Tarkenton? Why are you really here? As a human being, as a business person, all in one, right? Why are you here? You're here to help make other people's lives better. To help make your wife or your husband better. To make your children, your grandchildren better. Why do I have friends? Because I'm just such a wonderful person? What have I done to earn that friendship with you, Jay? I've got to give you something. I've got to make your life better. I've got to be focused on you. So I, all of a sudden, I thought I'd had all these things all my life, but I didn't have them near as much. I refocused my life. And me was not as important anymore, because I refocused on you. And I, if you will, I externalized my emotions and my thoughts. And the reason I'm here is to make you better, to make a customer better, to add value to someone else. And when I can focus all of my energies, all these negative energies, into a positive force to make you better, my friend, to make you better, my spouse, to make you better, my child, to make you better, my customer, then with the energy there, I can accomplish amazing, wonderful things.
I agree. This is interesting. So whether I'm a business owner, male or female, whether I'm running and P&L responsible for a large or small business, whether I'm managing a division, what you're saying to me, it sounds like, is that if I can move my own self-interest out of the way and concentrate on whatever I can do to make you my employee, you my customer, you my vendor, you my husband, you my wife, happier, richer, more secure, more productive, more profitable, this is a wild concept. I'll profit along with that?
You will profit beyond your wildest expectations. Let me tell you in real terms. I've been doing public speaking for 25 years. Last year, I did 40 speeches. That's about standard. I changed. My focus went out. I used to go and make a speech, and I'd come in and make your speech. If it was going to be a noon speech, I'd get there at 11:59. I'd make my hour speech. At 1:01, I'm out of there.
Yes.
Because, you know, you ought to be lucky to have me there. And I said, that's wrong. Because this realization that I've gone through in the last number of months, I said, that's not right. I'm there for one reason, to make your meeting the best meeting that you've ever had and to bring value and pleasure to your meeting. So if I'm going to do that, I need to get to know what you want.
Interesting.
So I spent time on the phone before I went there. I would get there early. I would talk to you. And you would. I'd say, what would you like to accomplish in your meeting? What's the makeup of the people? If you had a perfect setting and a perfect meeting and perfect info, what would it be? And you would tell me. And I would make sure that I delivered for you what you needed to be delivered to make your meeting the most successful meeting. And then after the meeting, I made sure I stayed around to be able to talk and to bond and to share with the people. And just by changing my preparation, changing what I did, changing my attitude, changing my focus from me going to speak to you and you give me money, that wasn't the focus. The focus was making your meeting the best meeting in the world. So this year I'm going to do 80. And the demand for mine is beyond 80, but I can't even take care of the demand. Before, it was a stretch to get 40.
That's wonderful. I want to ask you, as an NFL Hall of Fame athlete, I want to know what lessons you took from football or sports or from that competitive arena and translated to business that you'd like to summarize and share with me, a business owner, me, a manager, me, an aspiring business owner.
That number one, that I could not do it alone.
Interesting.
That I needed teammates, and the teammates need to talk together, share ideas together, work together, because the team was so much stronger than the individual.
Great point. Now, I've enjoyed our relationship for a number of reasons. One of the real joys that I've gotten out of it is my observation of your sense of certainty. I know that that was a driving force in your sports career. It can't help but have been a foundational force and element in your business success. Help me learn how to become more certain, more confident, more courageous in my conviction about my deserving greater success, my companies, my family, myself being entitled to achieve so much more. Because you obviously, you understand that, you live it, you radiate it. I mean, when you have a vision, you don't balk, you don't flinch, you don't equivocate, you go for it.
I go with the conviction to the customer, but in the end, they are going to validate to me that my conviction was right or my conviction was wrong.
You don't take it personally, do you?
I don't take it personally. So when they come back to me that this idea is not going to fly, that this is not really something that I want, I have to look at that for what it is and then abandon that idea. Maybe that idea will lead me to another idea that will be closer to what they want. And I keep doing that process until I'm finding something that will be what they want and what they need and what they will buy.
Which leads me to the logical next related question. When I met you, about 2 or 3 weeks later, you called and said something to me, and you repeated the same thing today at a meeting we had before this interview with John Zahody, our producer. It's, what's your feeling about doing your homework and doing your research? You said, John, I've done my research on you. When you talked to me the second time, you said, Jay, I've done my homework on you. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on homework and research in the business arena.
I think it's important to know about as much about the people that you are in business with as you possibly can. To know their history, to know what they think, to know what made up their uniqueness. Maybe have got a head start on the strengths of that person, the weaknesses of that person, and I can determine whether I can deal with the weaknesses or not and enjoy the strengths of that person, because we all have strengths and weaknesses, and we have to see how that fits with what we're doing. I think relevant information before I act and as I'm acting is critical.
So how do you
because
do it?
I've got to generate it before I act. I've got to generate information from other people's experiences with you and John.
So will you call somebody and just start asking questions? What do you know about him? Tell me about him. Is he good? Is he bad? What's he done?
I call people that I know, that you know, that John knows, and says, tell me about John. Tell me about Jay. Tell me about what they've done. Tell me about what they think. Tell me about, are they credible? Are they not credible? Are they real? Are they not real? Let me know. And people want to tell you. And then you've got to do some interpreting yourself, because maybe you're calling somebody who's got an axe to grind. And if you
probably might get a mixed comment, you have to
evaluate. You might get a totally opposite comment from how things really are, and you've got to be sensitive to that to know. If I get a negative about somebody, I really want to dig and explore to see where that really comes from. And so many times, where that comes from is a jealousy.
Yes.
Or people really would like to tear down that person because it makes me be a little bigger and a little better in your eyes. And so you start doing that, and then as you find that out, obviously you don't trust that source as much anymore. Now, after you get going and you start your projects out, then I think information is critically important to understanding what your business is and how you're doing. So many people do not know how they're doing till it's too late. So they cannot make the adjustments as they go along. I have told my daughter in her business, every day you ought to know exactly how much cash you brought in, where you brought it in from, who bought what, when did they buy it. And the more information you have, the more you'll know about your marketplace, the trends of your marketplace, who's buying what, who's not buying what, and how to then sell or advertise or market into that place that is generating the revenue for you. Business is a constantly evolving game of strategy based on good, solid information, not based on whims or what we hope might be. It's based and driven by good, hard information that we got to look at realistically in order to make the adjustments that we need to make to, again, do what? Serve our marketplace with products and services that make them better. And if you don't have that information, you are not a business person, you're not an entrepreneur, you're not a risk taker, you are a gambler. And at the end of the day, gamblers will lose. The odds are stacked against gamblers. These people, the real entrepreneurs, the real driven business people who are driven to add that value, that are information-based and driven, not a gamble. It's a risk, but it's a calculated risk that will bring rewards eventually.
That's a great answer. Great answer. Now, Fran, you associate with, hang out, fraternize, vacation with, sit on the boards with some of the most dynamic, powerful, wealthy, influential, most newsworthy men and women. You've seen a lot of entrepreneurs, large and small. If somebody's making 100, 1,000 times more than me, it can't be because they're 100 or 1,000 times smarter. It's humanly impossible. It can't even be that they started with 100 or 1,000 times more capital in the beginning, because most people don't have that much advantage. How and why are some people 10, 100, 1,000 times more successful and wealthier than others? What's their secret, and how can I utilize that to my own business advantage?
Very, very interesting question. And my first response to you is, I don't believe that just because one person makes $1 billion out of an idea and another person makes $10,000 out of an idea, that the $1 billion person is a lot more successful than the $10,000 person. Because, again, I think the people that I know, and I know some that have, and I will describe them, that have made billions of dollars. And some that have been equally successful who've made thousands of dollars. And I think that what they both have in common is they have an obsession with creating value for somebody else. Let me talk about that.
Great.
One of my great, wonderful friends who passed away a few years ago was a guy by the name of Sam Walton. You ever heard of him?
Of course.
Sam Walton started a little company called Walmart, and I spent days and hours and weeks and months with him. He didn't really start Walmart until he was in his mid-40s. He was a franchisee for the Franklin Discount Store. He had a couple little discount houses in Arkansas. And he became frustrated, and he was saying, you know, my business is doing fine. I'm not starving. My family is being fed and educated, and I'm paying the mortgage, and I'm doing all the things, and I'm in this little city of Bentonville. But I know I can do better. But he didn't say, I know I can do better. I believe I can change the face of retailing in this country. Here's a little simple guy, Sam Walton. Nobody knew. He didn't have a Harvard MBA. He didn't have the proverbial silver spoon when he was born. He wasn't endowed with money and wealth. He wasn't Phi Beta Kappa. None of those things. He wasn't obsessed with making Sam Walton wealthy. He never lived like a wealthy man. But what he's obsessed with is three things: quality, value, and service. I asked him, I said, Mr. Sam, I said, how did you do this? He said, I went out to my competitor's store, and I'd stand outside the store, and Mary and John would come out of the store, and I'd say, Mary and John, Sam Walton, you know, I've got a store down here. I said, how can I get you to come down here and shop in my store? He said, they told me, give us better quality of merchandise, better value, and better service, and we'll come down and see you. And I really thought I was doing that, you know? We all think, well, I'm working hard. I am really focused, and I'm really giving quality, value, and service to my people. But he said, evidently, I could do it better. I wasn't doing it well enough. And I thought about that, and I said, boy, you know, if I can improve that 20% or 30%, if I can really start a store of my own, just a little bitty store, and just focus on providing quality and value and service, quality products at the lowest cost and great value, and service those people and focus on that customer, I could build a business. And this wasn't 1900, this was 1961. Sears Roebuck was dominant, was it not? Montgomery Ward was dominant. Kresge Company were huge companies. This was the retail business. He started a little store, maybe 8,000 square feet, now a museum, in Bentonville, Arkansas. Not in Los Angeles, not in New York, not in Detroit, not in Chicago. And there, based on the principle quality, value, and service. And you go there, and you go in the Sam's Clubs or the Walmart stores that have now gone from, when he died, $50 billion in sales to $80 billion in sales. They're still obsessed with providing quality, value, and service to the other people. Mr. Sam died, he was worth $22, $23 billion. He drove a used pickup truck, lived in a modest house in Bentonville, Arkansas. He didn't have a second home. He didn't have a fleet of jet airplanes that he flew. He had his own private plane that he is a prop plane that he actually piloted himself, because he wasn't obsessed with making money himself. He was obsessed with doing something for other people. So that separated him from all of those who want to make so much money for me. If I make so much money for me and I'm worried about that, that that's my drive, I may even sell people something they don't want. And eventually I will be found out. But I'll take you to Ruth Brooks. I don't believe she has a high school education, certainly not a college education. Sits in that little town of between Clayton and Clarksville, Georgia, and a little town on the outskirts of Batesville, population 20 people. And yet she understands that she has got to give something to the people. Service and price. And then there's another story. You know, I've mentioned before my friends Sidney Marcus and Arthur Blank, who are the chairman and president and co-founders of Home Depot. Now, 1978, they worked for Handy Andy in California. They were fired. They weren't 20 years old. They were mature men. And they said, woo, let me see. We would like to start a store that we would like to shop at. We would like to start a store that we would be scared to compete against. So they used the experience that they've had in the past and externalized again and thought about what would be the kind of store they would like to shop in. And in 1981, they started Home Depot. This year, they're going to do $15 billion in sales. So what's the consistent theme in this? It's very simple and basic and fundamental. It's biblical, is it not? Do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. Add value to other people. It's a simple message. And so my friends who have made this money have had a simple message. Bill Gates at Microsoft. He leveraged IBM, if you will. He was a little $4 million company. IBM was out looking for an operating system for its PC. Bill Gates said, "Woo, I could leverage this. I could develop this operating system. I could sell it separately, but IBM is going to encase it with all the PCs they sell. This is good. I'll form this partnership." And he leveraged, as a little $4 million company, this richest company in the world, and leveraged that because he could give them something that would help them sell more PCs. And then as he grew on, he found out that for him, the user of PCs were the people developing systems, the people that were technically oriented, the developers of applications for companies. So he made sure that his marketing was into that group of people, because the presidents and chairmen were not buying from him. The people using the PCs and building the applications and keeping the information flowing in the company, they were the ones buying. So he made sure that he communicated to his buyer. IBM was a big company. They weren't going to talk to the technicians and worker bees. They got more important than the real customers they have, and so therefore they failed to talk to them, they failed to listen to them, they failed to understand what they wanted, and Bill Gates was already there, and he went right by them. So again, it's the knowing who your customer is, knowing what your customer wants, and focusing onto that customer. Those are the ones that have created huge wealth, and they weren't necessarily rocket scientists. They weren't necessarily the smartest people in the world. Bill Gates, people think, is a genius. He may be. A genius in what? He dropped out of college. He didn't have an MBA. But he focused on bringing, or knowing who his customer was and bringing value to his customer, and he continues to do so, and he's continually obsessed with that. He's not obsessed with his own wealth. He's not obsessed with his own things. But he's obsessed with continuing to grow his company. And that separates the people that make it and the people who don't.
Fran, you said something a few moments ago that I was really intrigued with, and I'd like to ask you to comment a little deeper. You said that just because somebody made a lot more money didn't necessarily mean they were a lot more successful. What did you mean by that?
I don't think money is the only measuring stick or the most important measuring stick. I think the successful people are the ones who truly add real value and help make somebody else's life better. Let me take it for instance. Jonas Salk. He didn't have the wealth of Sam Walton when he died. He didn't have the wealth of Bill Gates. But did Jonas Salk make a contribution to the world?
Indeed.
Indeed. He came up with a polio vaccine. But there are many lesser visible stories than that, that of people that have made other people's lives richer and better, that maybe made money during that particular time, but weren't the wealth of the Rockefellers or the Carnegies or the Bill Gateses of modern times. So to me, your success is what you have contributed to other people's well-being during your lifetime. Now, that doesn't degrade making money. That doesn't make Bill Gates bad or Sam Walton bad. They created good value for them. They made a lot of money. But it's not the sole measuring stick of how successful you are.
So I may be being far too hard on myself if I'm judging my success or my non-success by the fact that I haven't yet hit the millionaire mark or the 10 millionaire mark or the $500,000 a year mark. If I'm doing good work and I'm adding good value and I'm benefiting my customers or my clients.
Yes. And let me extend that thought, if you will. I had a friend of mine who was chairman of the board of a very large textile mill I was a young man, 28 years old, and I was just starting my family. And we were playing golf one day, and he says, oh my goodness, my daughter is 21 and she's getting married next month. I don't know where the time has gone. He said, you know, I have great wealth. I have made a lot of money. I'm in an important position. I'm chairman of my company. But I've sacrificed my time with my family. I don't know my daughter. I will never, ever overcome the loss that I feel for not getting to know my daughter for these past 21 years. And he said, Fran, take that advice and don't let that be the story you tell when your daughter is 21 and is about to get married. And I really took that to heart, and he really had something to say. So what if we just make hundreds of millions or tens of millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars, and in the process there we have destroyed people? We have ruined lives. We have lied. We've cheated. Or maybe we didn't lie, we didn't cheat, but we just sacrificed our family, the time with my children. That's not a proper sacrifice. That's not success to me, no matter how much money I might have made. But let me tell you the good news. That should not detract from your ability to make money. I've got four children. I've got a 30-year-old, a 26, a 25, and a 7. I've got a 5.5-year-old granddaughter and a 1.5-year-old granddaughter. I have spent wonderful time and continue to spend great quality of time with them while I drive my new ideas, while I drive my new businesses and have driven my last 8 businesses. I do not look back now and say, I have not spent the time. I have not been there for them to help them grow and be wonderful human beings and add value to their lives. I have, and I feel really good about that. I feel better about that than I do about making money, obviously. But the two do not have to be mutually exclusive. They can both be done and done well.
That's great. I got a couple more. This is wonderful. Okay. This is wonderful.
Is it rain out there, or is that just the ocean?
It's the ocean.
It comes up, it's right there.
Yeah, it comes right up to the house sometimes. Yeah. It's pretty neat. If you like surf, it's really nice.
Right there.
If you don't, it's really intimidating. This is a very personal in a very private question I'm going to ask. Hopefully you'll be willing to answer it. You're 55 years old. You've seen a lot of life. You've seen a lot of winning. You've seen a lot of competition. You've seen a lot of businesses. You've seen a lot of sides to people. You've seen good. You've seen probably not so good. You've seen the exhilaration of success. You've seen the agony of defeat. You've seen the human arena at so many different levels. What's the one lesson you've learned today that you wish you knew back when you started, and among all the other things you'd like to give to me so that I could take heed of it, take it to heart, and take fullest advantage of it right now in my life, in my business?
It's a very good question, and I've got today an answer for that question. And it would not have been the same answer a few years ago. But because of all those life's experiences that you have mentioned, that I've had through these 55 years, because of the most recent experience I had with my software company the last year, the thing that I wish I'd have realized earlier, but I'm glad I realized now, is that the great thrill and joy of life is not personal benefit. The real joy and thrill of life is to understand that I'm here on this earth, I'm here on this planet to contribute to somebody else, to make things better for you, to make things better for my spouse, to make things better for my children, for my friends. And I've got to be a great caretaker to that, and I have got to really focus all of my energies on making those relationships better and giving to those relationships with no regard to what comes back to me. The real true friendship, is it not, to give without any notion of receiving? I do for you. It's not that you owe me now that I've done for you. I did that because of my love for you and my concern for you. And in business, it is no different. Because if you are going to bless me with the confidence of buying my product and services and being my customer. My whole focus should be to be obsessed with your happiness and what you get out of that, not what I get out of that. And since I've made that transfer in dramatic terms in the last few months, my life is richer today than it's ever been. My relationships are better today than they've ever been. What I feel, the fullness that I feel today, I do not feel anger and hatred toward other people. I do not have revenge in my heart to go and get people who have left me, abandoned me, written bad things about me, talked bad about me, stolen from me. I really don't have anger toward those people because my focus is going forward into making things better for the people that I've just mentioned. And since I've really understood that as well as I understand it today, in a whole kind of revelation and discovery, that is the essence of fulfillment. Not only are my relationships so much more rich and full now, but I'm doing more significant work today than I've ever done before because of this new discovery to something that's always been there. You say, well, I knew that. Well, maybe you did. I didn't have the clarity of understanding of what that really meant. So it's fueled a new me at age 55. I have made more dramatic change in my life in the last 6 months than I had in the previous 54 and a half years. So that's what I've learned, and that's what I'd like to give to you, my friend, and to that person who's listening to us right now.
It's wonderful. This has been an exceptional interview. You're a very gracious man. You're a very knowledgeable man. You're a very giving man. And it's obvious you're a very happy man. And I think I have been enriched by the experience, and I know somebody else listening who has also. Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity, Jay.